Hello, America, and all of our listeners all over the world. You're listening to yet another exciting edition of Let's Weekend. I'm your host and most, Brandon Perkins. Joining me, as always, is Chris Deloge. Say hi to the good people, Chris.
Hello.
Yeah, so this is for March 9th, 2024. We are going out of winter and into spring. And by that, I mean that the time changes tonight. That's just going to be so much fun.
Yeah.
I swear it's the day we finally get to the point where we no longer do this stupid shit is going to be a day we all celebrate, because the whole time changing thing is such bullshit. It has proven to be such bullshit, and yet we still do it every damn year. But anyway, so in the meantime, we're also got a cold front moving in, so nights are going to be rather cool over the next couple of days here, and then start warming back up again as we start getting into spring proper. But anyway, on the show tonight, we have to say goodbye to probably one of the most influential cartoonists of the last, I'm going to say, 50, 60 years. Like, this man's work, you can pretty much go to the darkest, most isolated parts of the world, and if you show one of these guys' characters, they will instantly know who he is. Like, we're talking about a man whose work was so beloved, the freaking, you know, the publicity people from the government of China announced a freaking "We mourn his death." Like, that is how much this man has affected people's lives. And he rather suddenly died this week. We'll be getting to him, of course. We have, of course, some other news, including a former Air Force employee who was indicted for disclosing classified intel in the dumbest way possible. We have some news in the entertainment front, including Warner Brothers Discovery going through their slash and burn phase again just to save that much more money for their shareholders. We got a bunch of political news, including some of the results of Super Tuesday. We've also got Supreme Court news, and George Santos wants to run for House again, but for a different seat. We'll tell you which one, because it makes him so very petty. And we got that and more on this week's episode of Let's Weekend. But before we start this off as always by talking a little bit about all the things we've been doing this week. And as always, we start with Chris. Chris, what have you been doing this week?
Enjoying the up and down weather that we've gotten. A number of days in the 50s and 60s. And then, as is tradition here in Northeast Ohio, then it's immediately back down to the 40s. And tomorrow we're going to be in the right around the freezing temps as we get a little bit of snow. Mostly cold, but gonna make for a fun time there. But yeah, haven't really done too much. I did get my tax refund check, so I put that into the bank. And the once every like 6 months I go to a bank to do anything at this point, so that's fun. And really about it. Been watching some stuff. I watched Spaceman on Netflix, which is
the Adam Sandler movie.
Yeah. Where he finds a weird space spider creature on his ship as he's, I think, like 500,000 kilometers away from Earth, somewhere around like Jupiter, kind of distance away from Earth is sort of the furthest a human has gone out. He's obviously experiencing a lot of loneliness and all that. And this weird spider creature shows up that has a human mouth and tentacles to it as well, to make it just a really fucked image to watch and all that. So yeah, that's the movie's good, but fuck that spider and creature.
Yeah.
Fuck it good. So yeah, that's the whole thing. So yeah. Recommend watching it, but I definitely kept it like on my other monitor while I was watching and had other stuff going on, so I wasn't, you know, seeing the spider too much. But yeah, the only other thing I really watched, I started a rewatch of Dragon Ball because of the events that happened, but we'll get to that a bit later. And our game's been playing some more Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, kind of redoing some stuff that I lost in a crash that I had. So we're going to wait through that. I'll put some more time in here over the weekend. So, but yeah, still looking at a lot. And then more Fortnite. Played a bunch this week because I finished up what I needed to do before the new season starts. Got all my Solid Snake stuff, got all the important stuff I needed out of that. But also dipped back into the Rocket Racing and the Fortnite Festival stuff, because they have put out some upgrades, updates for that stuff. So Rocket Racing has, they added a new mode that is essentially Trackmania. So they put up a track for people to play, a group out of like 8 or 10 or whatever, and you just keep doing it over and over again for like 5 minutes to try to get the best time. That's how you do the ranking stuff for that, figure out who wins, that kind of stuff. So that's pretty neat. They've also added some more tracks and such for that. So that's still pretty good. And then the Fortnite Festival, they added a fifth note lane to it for the higher difficulties. So you have a bit more challenge there. I think it uses left and right on the D-pad for the left side, and then a square, triangle, circle for the three on the right, which takes a bit getting used to, but also I had a bunch of quests that just required me to play songs, and I found a couple that had, like, you know, one of the instruments was a rating of one, which means it's incredibly easy. So
yeah,
you just crank that up all the way and you get a fun time with that stuff. So they also put a bunch of Blink-182 and Lady Gaga stuff, because those are like the two featured artists on there right now, though Lady Gaga is the only one that has herself in there as a character model that you can kill people with. So
yeah,
there you go for that. And yeah, that's pretty much all I've been doing. So what have you been doing, Brandon?
Well, as for me, now that Persona 3 Reload is all done and my my review is up on the website now, I decided to move on to other things. And I got a copy of Unicorn Overlord for my PS5. This is the newest game from Vanillaware. And as you can expect from a Vanillaware game, it looks gorgeous. It is absolutely breathtaking how beautiful it is. The animation is great. If you've played a Vanillaware game, you know that the at the very least, in spite of anything else, the artwork is going to be amazing. And it is. It still is very much here. And if you're also wondering, oh, what about the other thing that Vanillaware is most famous for, which is the fan service? Is it there? Yeah, yeah, it's there. It's not quite as gratuitous as like Dragon's Crown was, but I mean, to be fair, everything in Dragon's Crown was gratuitous. Anybody who's played that game knows that it's not just that it was gratuitous; it was also exaggerated to like an absurd degree. Which is part of, honestly, kind of part of what that game's appeal. But yeah, it's still here. You still got the jiggliness and the fan service. But like I said, it's not really as gratuitous as it is here. Like, yeah, you still got the, you know, the scantily clad characters and the large, you know, breasticles and stuff jiggling. But it's not to the absurd degree that like some of the past Vanillaware games are. It's still there if you look for it, but you kind of you have to dig for it to find it. But as for like what actual kind of game it is, Unicorn Overlord is essentially a simulation RPG. People make comparisons to Fire Emblem. That's not really what it's like. It's sort of like Fire Emblem in some ways, but for one thing, it doesn't have permadeath, which is, you know, kind of the big, you know, big difference between that and Fire Emblem. Also, unlike Fire Emblem, you're, well, yeah, I guess that's also kind of a thing in Fire Emblem too. At least in some of the early ones where you could like hire on mercenaries and stuff to like increase your ranks. That's also in here. And it does also kind of have like a, the sort of rock, paper, scissors system that a lot of those games have where, you know, certain classes are more effective against others. But other than that, it's more, it takes more after like games like Ogre Battle and games like that. For one thing, combat in this game doesn't really work the way that Fire Emblem does. In Fire Emblem, you've got all your like individual units out on the field, and you're individually like, you know, moving and directing them, you know, with the amount of, you know, time and, you know, resources you're given before the next character takes their turn. This isn't really a turn, well, it, in principle, it's not really a turn-based thing here. All of the various units and stuff in this game move in real time, including the enemies. So you're always kind of having to make sure that, you know, your fortifications are defended and stuff like that. Because if your enemy manages to capture your, you know, your home base, then yeah, that's game over. But as for like the actual combat, what you end up doing is you have these small platoons that you have of up to like 4 to 5 individuals that you can get. And it starts out with each one is only like 2 maximum. But as the game goes on, you get resources that you can use to unlock more platoons you can put on the field and also increase the numbers of units you can put in one platoon. And when you come up against an enemy, it all happens sort of automatically. The combat in this game is not so much like thinking on the ground in combat as it is pre-planning your combat and making sure that you've got all of your units that you need for that particular fight, as well as all the effects that those units will have, because different units have different things that they can do. Like, for example, you've got hoplites, which are these big hulking dudes with spears that also have these enormous shields that can defend the whole platoon from the enemies you're going up against. There's also you've got your basics like the hunters. You know, those are archers. They can, you know, pick off people from a distance, and they can also, if you're got more than one archer in your group, they can actually rain arrows down on the enemy when you're in combat. And then you also have like spearmen they use spears and they can basically like hit the entire group of people in the platoon with one hit. So it all happens automatically. So, you know, once you and one platoon and another platoon encounter each other, the combat happens and it happens automatically. And it looks amazing while it's happening, of course, because it's a VanillaWare game. But as far as like the actual, you know, that's about the extent of what the combat does. And of course, you got other stuff you got to do. You got to like free up garrisons that'll let you spawn new units from specific places on the field. In the overworld, you have to go around and like liberate various towns. And once you do that and you help them rebuild, you'll be able to like buy stuff from them. You'll also be able to make deliveries to them that will increase the reputation of the Liberation Army, which is what you're commanding, basically. I will say, as far as like the story goes, the story is very troperific. It's told really well, though. Don't get me wrong. It's written very well. They sort of took the very kind of beige prose of the Japanese original and gave it this sort of pseudo-medieval approach to it that makes it sound, that just makes it very gripping to watch. And there's like new characters showing up just about every time. So it's like it never gets old. If you like simulation RPGs, yeah, you need to get Unicorn Overlord. It is one of the best games of its type. This is legitimately going to be one of my Game of the Year contenders. It's that good. But other than that, I've also been playing a little indie GM called Pacific Drive, which is basically a game where you get stuck in this place in like this mountainous part of, I think it's Oregon, where you get, where you're stuck in this place that's called like the Olympic testing site or something like that, that was abandoned back in the 90s. And you end up accidentally getting sucked into it. And so you basically have to navigate it using a beat up old station wagon that will take a serious beating as you're playing this game. You are constantly having to replace and fix parts for it. And it's legitimately like fun to play. Like it's really easy to get sucked into this game's universe. And the thing is like, it's really unpredictable. They say at the very beginning that there's this weird phenomenon that's happening in the zone because there was some sort of experiment or something that happened, and now like bits and pieces of reality are just sort of phasing in and out of various places. You know, just rocks are disintegrating. There are parts of the ground that are just, you know, ruptured up into the sky. There are these weird mannequin things that show up like just blocking roads, and you don't want to touch them because if you do, they explode, and just a bunch of other weird shit. And it's legitimately fun, like really fun. It's really easy to just get lost out there because there's just so much to find. And yeah, it's really good. And on top of that, I'm still going through Rebuild of Evangelion. I'm in the middle of the third movie right now, which is definitely completely unlike the original series. This is the point where Rebuild of Evangelion legit goes completely off the rails and into a completely new timeline all its own. At the very end of the second movie, there's this thing that happens that causes like this 14-year time skip when the next movie starts. And when Shinji wakes up, he finds out he's on board this like battleship that looks like it may or may not be out in the middle of the Arctic Circle, because it's like surrounded with icebergs and stuff. And everybody hates him. You know, Miss Misato hates his guts. Asuka hates his guts. All the people who are staffing the ship hates his guts. And it turns out, well, I'm not going to spoil it because, again, it's damn good. And if you love Evangelion, you absolutely have to watch these because they've got new characters that they add into it. They rewrite part of the stories to basically make it more make sense. It's so damn good. It really is. And like, it's incredible how like each movie in the series is better than the previous one. But yeah, it's really good. And other than that, I'm still job hunting. That interview that I was supposed to have this week ended up getting rescheduled to next week. So, you know, I got that to deal with. But yeah, other than that, yeah, that's pretty much what I've been doing. So have you got anything you want to add before we move on?
Nope.
Alrighty then. It's now time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's Random Factoid. And Chris, being that you're also a product of the American educational system, you probably know that, and not necessarily through the fault of the teachers, because they were taught a lot of this stuff as well. We got taught a lot of bullshit when we were kids, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not even talking like the controversial stuff. I mean, like the really like dumb fairy tale stuff. Like, here's one you probably definitely remember. Were you ever told the story about how George Washington supposedly, when he was a kid, supposedly chopped down a cherry tree?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, his father comes out and tells him, you know, why'd you do it? You know, who did this? And supposedly Washington says, I cannot tell a lie, father, I did it. And it impresses his father so much that he embraces him and says his honesty was worth more than 1,000 cherry trees, which is a cute story, but that's all it is. It's a story. It didn't happen. Yeah. Here's another one that you probably were taught. Why did Columbus set sail?
He wanted to reach the Indies.
Yes, that's the real reason. Now, what were we taught when we were little kids?
To discover America.
Yes, he wanted to discover America, but there was another thing he wanted to do. He wanted to prove something.
What? Going around the globe?
Yeah, he wanted to prove that the world wasn't flat. He wanted to prove that the world was round. Now, I know you're thinking, wait, that's if you went through school and you're thinking, wait, you know, I don't think I was. I was. And a lot of American kids were taught that, believe it or not. There were whole generations of kids who were taught that as a fact, that the reason Columbus decided to sail for the New World was because he wanted to prove that the world was round. Now, that's incredibly stupid, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think I ever heard that.
Yeah, well, you're lucky. Because anybody who can tell you, people have more or less known that the world is round about as far back as the ancient Greeks. And it's really not that hard to prove or, you know, to figure that out. All you have to do is, like, get on a beach and watch a ship sail off into the horizon. That's all you really need to be able to figure out. The Earth must have a curve. But for whatever reason, there were a bunch of kids, me included, who were taught that Columbus set sail because he wanted to prove the world was round. Now, and of course, they were also taught that cherry tree story as well. And a bunch of other stuff as well. Now, as it turns out, there's actually one guy you can blame for spreading these myths. And yeah, it's got to be someone you may have heard of, because he actually was a very big name. And he still is. You probably still read his work if you were like if you took high school English. And that was a gentleman by the name of Washington Irving. Washington Irving, famously of Rip Van Winkle and the Legend of Sleepy Hollow fame. Now, Irving is generally considered to be the first famous American man of letters. He started publishing his work in the early 1800s when he was in his 30s. And he very quickly became a major figure, not just in America, but also in Europe. In fact, he was the first American writer to become a major success in Europe at a time when, you know, the United States, as we know it, was still a pretty young country. When Rip Van Winkle was published in 1819, the United States, as we know it, had only been around for about 50 years. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, the early history of our country. Legend of Sleepy Hollow, Rip Van Winkle. He wrote a bunch of other short stories, too, and some poems and some other stuff because he was a man of letters. But he also had this side gig where he would write these biographies of people, of famous people. And when he did, he would always, like, insert this weird fairy tale bullshit into him to, like, teach some kind of moral. So, like, for the Washington story, it was the virtues of honesty and integrity. For the Columbus one, it was for the, you know, going against the crowd when you know you're right or the facts are on your side and not, you know, sticking to your guns. Both of which are, of course, you know, not bad values to want to teach. It's just, why'd you have to make up stupid shit to teach it? And basically, the story of how these got spread around in and of itself is kind of funny. So the Washington one actually did not necessarily originate from Irving. He actually got it from another guy named Mason Weems, who was a bookseller in, I think it was Connecticut, who wrote a biography of George Washington shortly after he had passed away. And he apparently was the first one, at least as far back as anybody can tell, who first put that concept of the cherry tree story into print. And then because you have to realize all the writers back then stole like from each other like crazy. Irving saw this and decided, you know what, he was going to put that in his own little project about George Washington. And so in the 1850s, when he started publishing his 5-volume biography of George Washington, one of the things that he puts in the very first volume is that cherry tree story that he himself did not create. He literally rips it almost wholesale from Mason Weems' book. And that ended up being sort of one of the most popular ways that myth ended up being spread. The other one, however, is 100% an invention of Washington Irving. It's a book called A History of the Life and Voyages of Christopher Columbus. It is a, quote, fictional biographical account written by Washington Irving in 1828. It was published in 4 volumes in Britain and in 3 volumes in the United States. It was the most popular treatment of Columbus in the English-speaking world until Sam Elliott Morrison's biography, Admiral of the Ocean Sea, which came out in 1942. So here's the thing. And for the record, this was not like the only kind of like fictional biography that he wrote. He also did one. I mentioned previously the one on Washington, which actually had more fact in it than fiction, except for what I previously met. He also did one on Oliver Goldsmith. He did a biography on the life and of the Muslim prophet Muhammad and his successors. And that also has some questionable bits in it as well. But the Columbus one is the one that is just, it's just rife with bullshit. And the weird thing is, he actually start this book off by saying, and I'm quoting here, "In the execution of this work, I have avoided indulging in mere speculations or general reflections, accepting such as rose naturally out of the subject, preferring to give a minute and circumstantial narrative, omitting no particular that appeared characteristic of the persons, the events, or the times, and endeavoring to place every fact in such a point of view that the reader might perceive its merits and draw its own maxims and conclusion." And there was a critic named William Hedges who said, "To a large extent, he may have been unconscious of his approach to history, and consciously he could not formulate his intentions except in stock phrases." And this is coming from Wikipedia. "One glaring weakness, then, of the work as a historical biography is perpetuating the myth that it was only the voyages of Columbus that finally convinced Europeans of his time that the earth is not flat. In truth, no educated or influential member of medieval society believed the earth to be flat. The idea of a spherical earth has long been espoused in the classical tradition and was inherited by medieval academics. Irving had previously engaged in such literary and historical hoaxes, and historian Jeffrey Russell argues that Irving never intended to write a serious history of Columbus. Rather, the superficial scholariness of the work, including spurious footnotes, was a joke at the expense of his readers." So, yeah, that's like just one of the things. This book is like rife with some other stuff as well. There's like some fanciful tellings of like what happened when he landed and met the Taino people. Now, Chris, you know what happened when Columbus finally hit land and he met up with the Taino people, right?
Yeah.
He robbed them all for his work, enslaved a bunch of them, and then took all their wealth back to Europe with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't say that here. I mean, granted, this is 1828, so we're not exactly looking for necessarily something that's meant to be seen through the eyes of 21st century logic, but it's pretty glaring. Washington Irving, he is the reason why, if you were ever taught as a kid that Washington chopped down a cherry tree or that Columbus tried to prove the earth was round, he's the guy that you have to blame. But on the bright side, he also wrote some pretty nice short stories that you probably read, and at least one of them was made into a pretty nice Disney movie. So, that has been yet another installment of Brandon's Random Factoid. So, with that out of the way, it's now to move on to the show proper. And as always with the show proper, we start off with our assholes of the week. And our first asshole of the week is this retired employee of the United States Air Force who has been indicted for disclosing classified information about the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war on a dating site.
Yeah. A 63-year-old civilian employee of the U.S. Air Force has been a Russian indicted for allegedly disclosing a secret national defense information mm-hmm. related to Russia's war with Ukraine. And yeah, the shared the classified information on a foreign online dating platform.
Mm-hmm.
He supposedly shared the information with a female claiming to be in Ukraine in early 2022, starting around the time when Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th of that year.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Yeah, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel before being assigned to a classified space in U.S. Mm-hmm. Strategic Command. Yeah, they allege that he attended top classified briefings related to the war and shared details about military targets and Russian capabilities to the female,
mm-hmm.
who called him her secret information love and secret agent in their messages. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the unidentified alleged co-conspirator would regularly ask Slater to provide her with sensitive, non-public, closely held information. So that seems very much like some sort of catfishing situation, just to mm-hmm. get this information out of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. If convicted, he faces a maximum of 10 years in federal prison, mm-hmm. 3 years of supervised release, and a fine of up to $250,000 for each yeah. of the three counts in the indictment. So
yeah,
that'll be a fun time for him.
Yeah. And then we have our other asshole of the week, which is George Santos. Yeah, he's wanting to run for the House again. But the difference is this time he's going to be running for the seat of the rep that led the effort to get him expelled.
Yeah. So instead of running for, I think it's New York 3, yeah. it's New York 1.
Mm-hmm.
He said here on Twitter, New York hasn't had a real conservative represent them since I left office arbitrarily, thanks to Rhino empty suits like Nick LaLotta.
Mm.
Who represents New York's first congressional district on Long Island. And yeah, LaLotta helped lead the effort to oust Santos from his third district House seat. It was revealed Santos lied about much of his personal and professional history. Mm. And after federal prosecutors indicted him on 23 fraud charges.
Mm.
But now he says he's going to try and oust him in the GOP primary that's happening on June 25th.
Mm.
So that's fun. And yeah, he obviously showed up at the State of the Union because he's a former member of Congress. And I guess being expelled does not get rid of the thing that former members have nope. to be able to enter the House whenever.
Yeah.
After they're done serving, which I feel like if you're being expelled or, you know, removed from office, that should mm-hmm. then revoke that stuff, but
it should.
That's probably not a thing that's ever been an issue, really.
Mm-hmm.
But now you got people like this guy that are pathological liars.
Oh, yeah.
That'll test the limits of these things, and I assume if Democrats get in control of the House again,
mm-hmm.
they would probably likely to maybe think about that.
Mm.
I don't know if that would be necessarily a high priority thing, but
yeah,
that's probably how it's still a thing. Is it's not really a high priority thing at any yeah. time.
Yeah, not really.
So yeah.
Oh yeah. But we do have some heroes of the week to be talking about. One of the big ones is that the first over-the-counter birth control pill is heading to stores later this month.
Yeah, O-pill,
mm-hmm.
first oral contraceptive pill to be available without a prescription in the U.S.
Yep.
A shift to retailers nationwide. It'll be sold online and in the family planning aisle of drugstores, convenience mm-hmm. stores, and supermarkets later this month. I believe it's $20 for a month's mm-hmm. worth of pills. So pretty decent price there.
Yeah.
It'll be a little cheaper to buy in bulk,
mm-hmm.
With a 3-month supply costing $49.99 and a 6-month supply for $89.99.
Mm-hmm.
So you can check out those options if you want to, you know, do it Costco or Sam's Club style. Just get a fucking 6-month supply of this stuff.
Yeah.
For that. But yeah. Typically, birth control pills are covered by most insurances. But
mm-hmm.
yeah, there's plenty of people that don't have it. And plenty of people that might just want to not adhere to a. Insurances that could just remove it at any time, especially yep. if they're provided by jobs
yep.
run by not great people.
Yeah. 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 But, yeah. And we also got news this week that the men's basketball team at Dartmouth is the first college sports team to unionize in the United States.
Yeah. Pretty cool to see. Yeah, they're led by their forward, Cade Haskins, and guard Romeo Myrtle. The 15 players announced their intent to unionize last September, arguing that the business of college sports is different than it was a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Tuesday's vote was 13-2 in favor of joining SEIU, Local 560. The election was held over the objections of the trustees of Dartmouth College.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Dartmouth is Ivy League, so there's plenty of money going around there. Which last week filed a motion asking the Neighborhood Relations Board to halt the election pending further review. And of course, the NLRB denied that request. On Tuesday, Dartmouth asked the NLRB to overturn the decision by the agency's regional director to hold the election in the first place, setting stage for a protracted legal fight. So they're going to fight this as much as possible. And yeah, kind of, at the heart of this election was the issue of whether college athletes should be considered employees and therefore have to the rights under federal labor laws to form unions and collectively bargain over pay and benefits for that kind of stuff. And yeah, there's obviously not many players at Dartmouth ever go to the pros. They're in Ivy League, so they're often going for higher and, you know, majors and all that kind of stuff out there. And I think especially the team they're fielding this year has not done very well. So, but there's a lot of other things, even beyond just pay, that are things that, you know, college players would like to have, like more guarantees over health care, especially in the event of major injuries where, you know, players can lose scholarships that then drop them out of the sort of health care that gets provided for them. That kind of stuff that I assume would be very much a key point here for that kind of stuff. So, yeah, we'll see how this goes because, yeah, it'll be fun to see. Though I think the better thing would be having a general union for everybody in, you know, college basketball or college football or whatever. Especially when, you know, they're working on, you know, big college football game and the pay that they are supposedly offering for that stuff is not great. And that's because it's all splintered and all that.
Oh yeah.
Versus, you know, the deals you have to do when you're making a, you know, an NFL or NBA game where it's pretty easy cut and dry stuff for that. So
yeah,
this will be interesting to see how this goes. Cause even for how long this will probably take, a number of these players won't be at the school anymore, but it'll still be the principal of the matter. So yeah, we'll see how this goes.
Yeah. And with that, we move on from the show proper to the proper show proper. And God, this one hurt. We have to say goodbye to Mr. Akira Toriyama. He passed away this week suddenly at the age of 68. His cause of death was I forgot what it was, but it's more than likely due to a head injury.
Yeah, subtural hematoma.
Yep, that's a head injury.
Yeah, essentially take a nasty hit and blood starts pooling in your brain.
Yeah. I don't even know where to begin at just the sheer influence that this one man and his work had on the popular culture of not just Japan, but the entire world.
Yeah. I don't think anime in pop culture would be as popular as it is without Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah. At least not outside of Japan. It wouldn't.
Yeah, because that was probably the show that anybody getting into anime in the
90s.
For a good stretch from the 90s to the 2000s.
Yeah.
That is probably the anime that most people got into.
Yeah.
Anime with. And then from there.
We did have like anime here in the U.S. beforehand that was moderately popular. You know, you had like Speed Racer and Astro Boy. Battle
and some of that stuff was kind of hidden as a Saturday morning cartoon.
Robotech is another good example.
Yeah. But Dragon Ball Z was the cool anime of the dudes that just fought and then,
yeah,
you know, powered up and was kind of a new echelon in shonen anime.
Yeah, it also was like probably the first one we got that wasn't like heavily altered, you know, plot or story wise. Because
at least if you didn't get it in super early,
yeah,
the initial localizations, but
yeah,
the Funimation one that most people got into is the one that made it a big deal, and especially for any sort of animation, it being serialized was a big deal.
Oh yeah.
You like the way it was aired on Toonami here is essentially as they got new episodes in, they would just air those every day. And then when they reach the end, they're like, all right, we're restarting this arc. And then you see it again. And then maybe at some point they're like, all right, we're starting over from the beginning. And you're seeing Goku and Gohan.
Yeah. Doing and keep thing. In mind, remember, the Dragon Ball anime was notorious for the amount of things that did not happen in episodes. So, and then of course there is the just absolute shit ton of filler episodes that they threw out too. But
you know, the theme songs and all that were very much a 90s thing of
throwing God, through this
new metal theme song. Yeah. It's just like talking about the dragon that you see like five times in all of Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah. Except, you know, unlike the original Japanese ones, which were actually really good. But
still good, but not the vibes that the original had.
Yeah.
Then there was Dr. Slump, which was before Dragon Ball Z, which influenced a lot of stuff, even though we never really got a localization here.
No, we didn't. The manga is available. All of it is available. All, I think 10 volumes of it you can get from Viz Media.
Some limited crossovers with Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah. Dr. Slump is also interesting because of just not just how big a success itself it was, but how fast of a success it was. It actually broke it actually pretty much made the record for the shortest amount of time between a manga being published in Shonen Jump and an anime for it being greenlit. It was like 3 weeks. And of course that wasn't even his first either. He still had like a bunch of one shots and stuff. In fact, this is just purely me. If you ever want to see like all the, like a bunch of the stuff that Toriyama did outside of Dragon Ball, all the stuff he did before he became famous, all the like one shots he did in between the time he was doing Dr. Slump and while he was doing Dragon Ball and afterwards, there's a fantastic giant hardcover book called the Akira Toriyama Manga Theater. Go get it. It's giant. It weighs a ton and it's like $30-something, but it's worth it.
Yeah.
It's got like all the very first manga he had published in Jump when he was just starting out. You can watch the evolution of his art style. You know, because here's the thing about Toriyama. Toriyama didn't actually like start out to be a manga artist. His training was actually in advertising. And part of the reason why his work was so unlike all the stuff that existed beforehand is because he was using, you know, the stuff he learned from being an working in, you know, advertising graphic design and then applying it to manga. So much of what we take for granted for like shonen anime now, and not just shonen anime, but just anime in general, almost all of it can be traced back to him. There is a point in time, a specific point you can point to where you had shonen stuff before Akira Toriyama and then shonen stuff that came after Akira Toriyama. Do you know what shonen stuff looked like before Akira Toriyama?
Probably more tame, I would assume.
It was no, actually the opposite. It was stuff like Fist of the North Star or City Hunter.
More hardcore stuff.
Yeah, more hardcore, more violent stuff. That was a bit more serious minded. Not that, of course, City Hunter wasn't funny at times. It was hysterically funny at times, but it was more than anything supposed to be an action story. And then out of nowhere, freaking Toriyama shows up and he starts publishing this weird little gag comic about this inventor and his little robot daughter. And it just, it explodes in popularity in ways that had not existed since Osamu Tezuka.
Yeah. Probably like a good early slice of life kind of thing.
Yeah, it was very much a gag thing. And it actually was like the whole slice of life thing really did sort of start in 1980 when Dr. Slump first premiered. And, you know, he has a lot to say in sort of making that genre popular, because Shonen Jump, as we know it, as it became like the powerhouse that we imagine it did, that all happened in the 80s. Because, again, you had Dr. Slump. You also had stuff like Kinnikuman, which over here we know as Ultimate Muscle. You had City Hunter. You had Fist of the North Star. You had stuff like Wingman and just banger after banger of comics that just came out one after another, just knocking them hit left, right, and center in popularity. And then what happens is, because of Toriyama's sheer popularity, well, okay, he does Dr. Slump, and Dr. Slump is a massive success. Like, it is one of the most successful manga properties in Japan's history. And, you know, keep in mind, this was also like right around the same time when, you know, like the whole romantic comedy thing also started happening. So you had people like Rumiko Takahashi, who did not do stuff in Shonen Jump. She worked for Shonen Sunday, which, you know, she had like a, you know, stuff like Ranma and stuff like that coming out. And even then, you can kind of trace it back to Toriyama's work. But what made Toriyama's work so unusual compared to a lot of the other stuff that existed at the time was its surrealness. Toriyama very famously did not plan out any plots for any of the work that he did, ever. He literally flew by the seat of his pants in every single piece that he ever published. And it shows, especially with the comic that came out after this, which was Dragon Ball. And Dragon Ball, very famously, was only supposed to last like a few volumes because he just wanted to do a funny sort of like Journey to the West type story by way of Jackie Chan. And of course, the thing kept going until like 1996. And Dragon Ball not only outdid Dr. Slump in popularity, it inadvertently absorbed Dr. Slump into it. Because Penguin Village is more or less a part of the Dragon Ball universe. But then again, Penguin Village may or may not exist on a completely other layer of existence and just kind of phases in and out of various places. But and then Dragon Ball not only stayed in Japan, as we all know, it went out to Japan. It made its way to Hong Kong and Thailand and the Middle East and over to South America and Latin America, all their populars of South Asia, India. It eventually made its way into China and became extremely popular there. Even in South Korea, where, you know, any type of Japanese-made product was actually illegal to import until like 1990, it was popular there. And that's only talking about the manga and anime portion of this, because there's another part of Toriyama's influence that's very much close to our hearts over at Smashpad, and that's the video gaming world.
Yeah.
Because he just so happened to be in on the ground floor of probably the defining JRPG, Dragon Quest.
Yeah, one of the first for that. And yeah, like Final Fantasy would not have existed without Dragon Quest.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he went to work on Chrono Trigger, which was a bunch of the big names in JRPGs.
You know, collaborating on a single project.
Yeah. And then even went on to make Blue Dragon as like an Xbox thing.
Yeah.
Much later on. And yeah, that's even before you even get to, you know, just the Dragon Ball games that we didn't really get much of here.
We got a bunch of them, but not all of them. Dragon
Power.
Yeah.
On the NES, that was just like We're going to cleanse all the weird stuff out of this.
Yeah.
And the licensing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So underwear turns into sandwiches and all this shit that makes it just a bad game, but a very fascinating one. But yeah, we didn't get most of anything that came out on the Super Nintendo or the PS1 outside of like right at the very end of the PS1 life where they're like, let's put out that crappy Dragon Ball GT game that nobody likes.
Yeah. But
because they barely printed any of it, it's got a cult following for that reason.
Yeah, we basically had to wait until the PS2 before we really started
started doing the Budokai games, where it's like, hey, these people fighting, we should make games about this, and then Atari publishes them, because that's a weird era there, before Bandai Namco absorbed the licensing back into it, and now is one of the main publisher of anime games. But yeah, that was a whole weird thing, but there's a ton of influence from Dragon Ball just outside of that, because you wouldn't have Sonic the Hedgehog without Dragon Ball.
Yeah, where do you think Super Sonic came from?
Yeah, a lot of Mario's comes out of Dragon Ball.
Yeah.
A lot of the key art is just a Rayleigh's, you know, way of running as Mario's running.
Yeah, you ever see any of, like, Shigeru Miyamoto's, like, actual artwork, and it's like, it's very clear he has a Toriyama influence.
It's all over video games, you know, just the general power fantasy stuff comes directly from Dragon Ball.
Yeah, and also just the art direction too. A lot of like NES related games, like they cribbed the crap out of Toriyama's work. Part of that was just because of the sheer success of Dragon Quest, which again, he was very much instrumental in the look of that universe and also the kind of goofiness that it often has.
Yeah, like the slime is like supposed to be the weakest enemy, but he just came up with a really cute design that just made it one of the most popular characters in games in Japan.
Yeah. And also he one of the things about his games but his manga that was so fun was the fact that he had this amazing ability to take any kind of complicated object and adapt it into his unique art style. There are so many illustrations, both in his manga and in his drawings, of planes and tanks and cars and machinery of all kinds that he, you know, boats and ships that he adapts to his art style and gives it this amazing, almost like miniature sort of like this diorama look to it. It's amazing. So it probably shouldn't surprise you to know that he was also responsible for designing a bunch of like model kits as well. But outside, of course, of manga, he did a bunch of other stuff too. He published a children's book called Tokyo the Angel, which is basically, it's like, what would happen if Akira Toriyama decided to write and draw a children's picture book? And it's exactly what you think it is. It's a fat little angel that looks a lot like Majin Buu that's riding on a sentient tank. Because of course it is.
Yeah.
And of course, outside of those two manga, he had some other manga series he worked on. He did Sandland, for example, which is getting a film and video game adaptation that actually should be out not too long from now. He also had a couple other short series. I know the one he did most recently was that, I think it was called Jocko the Spaceman, who ended up like becoming a character in the Dragon Ball universe. And in fact, that particular manga is funny because it shows a part of Goku's backstory that basically just straight up cribs Superman's backstory entirely. In fact, a lot of his work was him parodying just movies he liked. He probably parodied Alien like at least two or three times. It really, his legacy. You can go to any place on planet Earth, the most isolated parts of the world, and if you point to a t-shirt you're wearing and that picture has a picture of Goku on it, there's a 50-50 chance that they're going to go, oh, that's Goku.
Yeah.
Like, his appeal is genuinely universal. Like, there have been a bunch of photographs that have come out over the last couple of days of, like, pictures of, like, taquerias and, like, murals and, like, protest posters and stuff where they just, you know, just put Dragon Ball characters on them. Because, you know, it's that widespread.
Yeah, Goku's had a float in the Macy's Day Parade for the last handful of years.
Mm-hmm.
As the first anime character to breach that bubble there.
Yeah.
Do you think they've had Luffy in there as well up late in the last couple of years here?
Uh-huh. And just the absolute, just the peak of this man's influence. The day after it was announced that he died, the foreign minister of China made an announcement mourning the death of Akira Toriyama. Because, as you can imagine, considering how much of Dragon Ball pilfers from traditional Chinese culture and folklore, his stuff was pretty popular in China. So, yeah, that is the... And then, of course, the other big thing is basically all of the popular Shonen Jump properties that have come out after it, all of them, every last one of them, are inspired by Toriyama's work. Literally all of them. Yeah.
Anybody making manga and anime for the last 30 years will easily say that Akira Toriyama is a huge influence on them.
The single most popular manga of all time, One Piece. You know, Eiichiro Oda, very open about the fact that he was heavily inspired by Toriyama. The creator of Naruto, same thing. Even looking at Naruto, it's very obvious where he gets his inspiration from.
Yeah, they're very open about that stuff.
Yeah. Stuff like, you know, My Hero Academia, Yu-Gi-Oh!
Bleach.
Bleach. Even like the sports stuff, like Prince of Tennis or whatever. All of that stuff got its inspiration from Toriyama. So, and I mean, if you look back at it, pretty much all of the super duper popular manga of the last 20 years that came out of Jump, all of them basically get their inspiration from Toriyama in one way or another. You know, literally when they're, you know, when Jump was having like, what were the big three? Bleach, One Piece and Naruto, all three of them inspired by Toriyama's work. And probably will continue to be inspired by his work because, damn it, the guy hit on one hell of a successful formula.
Yeah.
And almost completely by accident. Like, the whole reason the Saiyan thing even started from the beginning is because he'd literally just run out of ideas. And he'd written himself into a corner, and he had to figure some way out. And he took a Hail Mary, and it worked.
Yeah, so, he created this race of people called Saiyans, and it's like, well, they got to have something to them.
Yep.
There's going to be some reason that they're not just humans.
Yeah. They can power up and turn into blonde and blue-haired superhumans, and they can also turn into gorillas for some reason.
Yeah.
Because why not?
Tails. Yeah. But yeah, that's... And then, yeah, just the influence on pop culture in the modern day is just bigger than probably any other source of, you know, of a creator. Because anime is huge, and like so many, you know, professional athletes, actors, musicians, you know, everybody in every walk of life, there's a lot of people that are influenced by this stuff. You know, famously, Michael B. Jordan talks about how much he is a huge fan of anime, more so Naruto. Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
So when he did like his clothing line, it's like legally distinct, if even that's designs from Naruto, but you get to...
It's really hard to overestimate, just to underestimate how, you know, how big like Dragon Ball is in the Black community. It's like it is everywhere in like hip hop culture. You'll find it. It's just So, R.I.P. Toriyama. For the record, Dragon Ball still isn't going anywhere. It is way too much of a cash cow for Shueisha. So, more than likely, the, you know, Dragon Ball Super is probably going to be handed over to the people who were his assistants up to this point, and Tsuyotomo, the guy who's the current artist. So yeah, it's still going to happen. It's still ongoing. He's just, unfortunately, he will not be, he, and I have, I kind of think that if not him, his estate at least made plans in case something like this happened. So yeah.
Yeah.
R.I.P. Mr. Toriyama, you left one hell of a legacy. But moving on from there, in political news, Nikki Haley has officially suspended her presidential campaign after she got absolutely shellacked in the Tuesday primaries.
Yeah. Definitely has not endorsed Trump, so
yeah,
no idea what, if she's just going to eventually go to that, like mm-hmm. just disappear for a bit until people forget what she was been trying to campaign on, and then
yeah,
move on to that, like a Ted Cruz kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
or anybody from that the 2016 campaigns yeah. where they all talked about how bad Trump was for America, and then as soon as he won, they're like, he's great.
Mm-hmm.
Campaigned for him and all that, so
yeah, because they're all spineless.
Yeah, but yeah, we'll see how she evolves or she just disappears. That'd be her smartest move, is just disappear instead of feeding into the Trump machine.
Mm-hmm.
Considering he's very much shown a lot of vulnerabilities in this stuff.
Oh yeah,
primaries.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that they had that weird Katie Britt response to the State of the Union. They're like, yeah, we needed a woman, then, you know, to market to, you know, the women voters out there. And it's like, you failed massively if you're trying to appeal to women.
Uh-huh.
You took this stereotypical looking woman who I believe was like a housemaker before she became a senator, and like, we're going to put her in the kitchen.
All right.
Where she belongs, you know.
Yeah. All
fun stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, her best move would be to do that, but she doesn't really have much of a political career left anyway.
Nope. But yeah, so like we said, the Super Tuesday happened this week, and she only managed to win like one state, which I think was Vermont.
She won D.C., you know, the
yeah,
the amazing place that is D.C. that doesn't get to vote for president.
No.
They get to do primaries, I guess, but not for president.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah,
same with the territories, isn't it? Isn't that the
yeah? I think like American Samoa and Guam both can't vote, and Puerto Rico as well. You know, unless you're a state, you can't vote. So,
and like all those should be states. All those people should be full citizens.
I wouldn't go that far. Not because I don't think they don't deserve sovereignty. I think that they should be allowed to be independent countries. But that's just sure. me. Puerto Rico in particular, if they do want to become a state, they should absolutely become a state forthwith, because yeah, they deserve it.
I mean, they should have the choice.
Yeah.
Because right now, Puerto Ricans are considered U.S. citizens, but a lot of the other territories are not.
Yeah.
Even if they serve in the military, they don't. And it's like, yeah, that's fucked up.
Yeah.
There's a lot of weird shit with that.
Yeah, there is.
It's due to our racist history, so.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, so those happened. And speaking of the ballots, the Supreme Court unanimously restored Trump to the primary ballot in Colorado this week, which I'm going to be honest, I knew that was going to happen. Yeah. It was just like, don't get me wrong. I appreciate the gesture, but it was on too shaky legal footing for it to happen.
Yeah,
it was a Hail Mary and it didn't work.
And also it's not going to affect anything either way.
Yeah, because he's still going to be the nominee anyway.
Yeah. This doesn't really change anything.
Mm-hmm.
But we should have the option of kicking traitors off of the ballot.
Yes, we should.
There was an amendment that seems to explicitly apply that, but
mm-hmm.
people are using too many weasel words to explain why the insurrection wasn't...
an insurrection.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, let's see. Yeah, so that happened. Then we got the good news that Senator Kyrsten Sinema will not seek re-election.
Yeah, her centrist campaign did not work.
No, because that's not who they voted for.
Yeah. Running as an independent
mm-hmm.
isn't going to work in Arizona, where they're either one side or the other.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to split the vote enough to win in any way.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's going to be Ruben Gallego and Carrie Lake, who, you know, claims she won the governor's race, but now is running for senator. So yeah,
she's still all in on the grift here.
Yeah, she's firmly in the Trump boats.
Not just politically, but also in her methods.
Yeah, she very much tries to invoke everything about him.
Mm-hmm.
Except when she's on camera, she makes sure she turns on that blurry filter for the background.
It's not really a filter. They just dump a jack ton of Vaseline onto the lens.
No, there is a filter for that, but she is a loon.
Yeah, there's that too.
She used to be like a TV anchor, and I don't think
she was
to the you know, the new voice of the Republicans, and it's like, no, you're too far out there for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So I would expect Ruben to win it, but yeah. We'll see.
We have been surprised before.
I would assume Carrie Lake has ruined the general opinion of her.
You would think that, but anyway. And as for other elections, Adam Schiff and Steve Garvey have advanced to the general election for the California Senate seat. This was the one that was vacated after the death of Dianne Feinstein.
Those two got the top two vote tallies.
Mm-hmm.
33% for Adam Schiff, 32% mm-hmm. for Steve Garvey. Mm-hmm. Katie Porter got 14% and Barbara Lee 8%.
Mm-hmm.
So those two are going to go fuck off, and then Adam Schiff's going to win.
Mm-hmm.
That's foregone conclusion. Even if Steve Garvey's a former Dodgers player, that's mm-hmm. they're not going to vote for that for a Republican mm-hmm. like that. So yeah, there you go. He's just running on shitty policies there, mm-hmm. as you would expect from the current GOP. So.
Mm-hmm.
Adam Schiff will be a senator hopefully by this fall.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. And as for other elections over in Texas, they have their Senate elections coming up, and the Dem primary ended up with Colin Allred, who won to face Ted Cruz in the Senate election as well.
Yeah. We'll see how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
He's a former professional football player who, first won a seat in Congress in 2018,
mm-hmm.
Endorsed by all the big labor groups,
mm-hmm.
The Texas AFL-CIO, and stressed his support for abortion rights. So
mm-hmm.
probably going to run on a platform of anti-Ted Cruz and anti-Greg Abbott,
mm-hmm.
And see if the general sentiment around those two
mm-hmm.
has soured enough that he can win.
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously a tall order.
Yeah.
Because we've seen solid candidates go against Ted Cruz
mm-hmm.
and still lose. But maybe this is the time where people see Cruz for what he is.
Yeah. I mean, let's hope. But also, you have to remember that politics in Texas are notoriously corrupt. I mean, just look who's the current governor.
Yeah.
And his whole cadre of sycophants and collaborators. And then we move on to just this other really stupid shit. So because of a court in, I think it was Alabama, saying that, you know, embryos are apparently children, there's just a shit ton of various people who have been just all over the country, including mostly GOP-involved individuals who are trying to get legislation to protect IVF treatments because they just had to open that little can of worms. And this week, Alabama's governor signed an IVF bill to give patients and providers immunity.
Yeah, it seems like this bill was largely a very basic thing.
Yeah.
Which means there's a lot of angry Republicans that are like, we need to put, you know, personhood clauses in this and all this other shit
mm-hmm.
in there. And it's like, well, thank goodness we didn't deal with that shit.
Yeah.
I don't know if there is, like, isn't any sort of weaselly language in here.
Mm-hmm.
but I don't think there is as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that'll be interesting to see, because this is a surprisingly new part of the culture war around all mm-hmm. of this abortion talk now. So that's, you know, something we got to thank the Alabama Supreme Court for.
And it's probably going to end up seriously biting them in the ass.
Yeah.
I freaking guarantee it.
I don't take it for granted, because IVF is also part of the anti-abortion stuff.
Oh, it's like, yeah.
That and contraception and all that stuff.
Yeah.
They want to get rid of it and go back to, like, the classic old Middle Ages thing of, you know, we're going to have soldiers make sure nobody's fucking. It ain't supposed to be fucking. They ain't married.
Yeah. Yeah.
All that fun stuff. And I was like, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. moving on from there, JetBlue and Spirit Airlines have abandoned plans to merge after it was blocked by a judge. Very good.
Yeah. Yeah. Two shitty airlines merging together for a shitty juggernaut. It's not great. Mm-hmm. Especially when there's only like 5 or 6 notable airlines anymore at this point.
Oh, yeah. Matter of fact, John Oliver did a whole segment on Boeing, I think, last week tonight. And let's just say that whole amalgamation of all the airlines, pretty much the reason why quality in general is just shitty for a lot of airlines right now.
Yeah. Because all the money people are running all of the airlines versus what used to be, you know, a lot of the engineers.
Yeah.
So they want to cut the corners on things that can literally kill people.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily don't kill people as much as they possibly could.
Mm-hmm. Next up, Apple was fined 1.8 billion euros for hindering music streaming competition on iOS devices.
Yeah. This is a whole fun thing with the EU having a good slap at Apple here.
Yeah.
About $1.95 billion for, quote, abusing its dominant position on the market for the distribution of music streaming apps, basically blocking companies like Spotify and others from being able to put anything in their app saying, like, hey, if you don't want to pay as much for this monthly fee or, you know, the music or whatever, you can go to our website and that'll save you some money. They block that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Apple applied restrictions on app developers, preventing them from informing iOS users about alternative or and cheaper music subscription services available outside of the app, which is illegal under EU antitrust rules.
Yep.
The EU ordered Apple to remove the so-called anti-steering provisions from the App Store, and to refrain from repeating the infringement or from adopting practices with an equivalent object or effect in the future. So,
yeah.
Yeah, they had another thing earlier this week where Epic was working on an app store that would be available on iOS, and then Apple just banned their account to be petty again.
Oh, yeah.
And EU had a talk with them, and they unbanned them. Of saying, like, oh, do you want more fines? We can lobby more fines if you want, but it might be a good idea not to do what you're doing.
Yeah.
Because Apple gets to fully approve and deny, you know, companies that want to work on those third-party app stores. And that seems like not a great thing for a company that's, you know, incredibly famous for locking things down as much as possible.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Apple got a nice little owie here.
Yeah. And now we got just some really, just once again, Warner Brothers Discovery showing just how little they care about creativity as a whole. Warner Brothers Discovery is shutting down Rooster Teeth after 21 years.
Yeah.
Rooster Teeth, of course, are famous for a bunch of projects, but probably the one that has had the biggest staying power is Ruby.
Yeah.
And Genlock as well is also pretty good. And
yeah, though that just had one season and disappeared.
Yeah.
But Ruby will probably be fine, because I believe they have production agreements with Crunchyroll. So
yeah, I'm already hearing like story. Apparently, like, it's considering they're shutting it down, it's possible. I have been hearing that Warner Brothers may be wanting to sell the IP, so we don't know yet.
But yeah, Rooster Teeth is a well-known... They're essentially a pioneer of the early internet age before YouTube existed to help company, you know, creators, you know, get their work out there. Rooster Teeth was, you know, taking Halo, the original Halo, and creating a machinima out of that, which works well because everybody's in helmets and they don't have to do a ton of, you know, work on a lot of that stuff. But they made that, it became pretty popular, and, you know, they had to host the all those video files on their own site. No, there were no, you know, real easy ways to do that. There's no Squarespace then to make that kind of stuff easy to do. I believe they had to do a lot of work on server stuff to allow all the traffic they were getting for that stuff. You know, they made that. They also made that show originally in an apartment.
Yep.
That all those guys shared, the founders.
Yep.
Managed to get some noteworthy voice actors in there as well early on for that. But yeah, kind of grew out of that whole thing. Like the first five seasons, and they went to an office to, you know, make it like you would expect any normal kind of show.
But, yeah,
you know, created their own big website that became its own kind of like forums and social media kind of thing.
Yeah.
And did podcasts, and then did other shows. They did a bunch of other machinima that didn't hit as well. There's one called Strangerhood that's made out of The Sims.
Yeah.
It's like a reality show, but The Sims. There's one made out of Fear, the original Fear.
Yep.
Maybe one or two others, but I was looking through their YouTube channels, being like, are these accessible? And you get the first season of Red versus Blue. The rest are all tied. I guess at some point YouTube allows you to tie in, you know, subscription services into your channel. So all that stuff requires their first membership from the website. So you'll have to pirate that stuff if you want to preserve it, really.
Yeah, because of course you do.
And Strangerhood, I think, is available. Like, the small stuff is available freely. But the bigger stuff, like Red versus Blue and Ruby and that, are all locked up under the subscription service. So you have to do plenty of work if you want to have access to some of that stuff. But yeah, they're also early force on, you know, Let's Play stuff with their Achievement Hunter brand, and then spun that into a channel called Let's Play that they, I think they locked that down well before Let's Play became, you know, the name for what that medium was.
Yep.
So yeah, it's kind of a wild thing there. Yeah, they kind of grew hugely. They did a lot of live action stuff, did a movie, and did a sequel.
Yep.
That kind of stuff. Yeah, it's just, there's a lot there. The podcast part of their company is going to keep going on.
Yep.
I believe they're supposed to be looking to sell that out. Spinning out his own thing and then selling that to somebody else.
Yeah.
And yeah, just getting, it's a, the inevitable thing that happens when a thing becomes too popular, becomes something that, you know, bigger companies want to buy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they got acquired by Fullscreen, which in turn was bought by Otter Media, which was a joint venture of AT&T and Churning Group.
Yeah.
And then that got bought by Warner Media. Yeah, because AT&T owns HBO and all that, Warner Brothers stuff. Then they spun that off to Discovery, and then Warner Brothers Discovery has been slashing at anything it owns for much of the last couple of years here. So yeah, there's going to be a lot of stuff going on there. So we'll see how that stuff goes. But yeah, I am glad I have the 10th anniversary Blu-ray for Red versus Blue. Though I liked Red versus Blue a lot less when they started doing their own custom animation stuff in that.
Yeah.
I like the charm of the original, but not saying it's bad or anything. Just it's jarring when you're like watching like the very like particular way that they're having to make use of the Halo engine, Halo and Halo 2 engines and all that. But yeah, it's a shame. This is a a pretty solid company. It's had plenty of problems over the years,
mm-hmm.
of shitty employees and bosses and such. So
mm-hmm.
that part of it sucks a lot, but
yeah
these people deserved a better send off.
Yeah, they literally found out like a few hours before like they were supposed to come to work, I think. It was like, God, and I don't know why all these shitty companies do that shit time and time again.
So they can lock down the workstations and email accounts and all that and prevent them from leaking things, I guess. I don't know.
I
control
guess.
Is basically what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
yeah.
Yeah, just short of their 22nd anniversary. It's April 1st, I believe, is there when they formally founded the company.
I couldn't even send them off with a good round number, could we?
No.
Golly, well.
Just shut them down about a month ahead of that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. I think they're a company that had a lot of problems with just making money.
Mm-hmm.
It was the thing that, you know, as YouTube became a big thing, they kind of bounced back and forth between hosting stuff primarily on their website versus putting it on YouTube and all that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you used to be able to just watch all of Red versus Blue and Ruby on YouTube. And then they're like, we got to sell DVDs and such.
Yeah.
And just lock it up again.
Yeah.
All that shit. And you just lose a lot of history. And then that's, unfortunately, they didn't make enough money to justify their existence.
Yeah.
And there you go.
Yeah. The good news is that the indie animation work, like, and all the, like, a lot of veterans come out on social media, like, hey, you got any, you guys need a job, hit me up. So, I mean, you know, people like, you know, the people in Glitch and Vivzy Pop has done one, Ross O'Donovan and Ego Raptor both have put out stuff. So, yeah.
A lot of those people stream and have their own YouTube channels and podcasts and such. So, a lot of them will be fine, though.
Yeah.
Living in Austin's not an easy place to live.
No, it is not.
Not anymore, at least. Not since everything blew up there.
Yeah.
Maybe had people in LA and Austin.
Yep.
Because, yeah, they bought up a bunch of other people, Funhouse, all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
People are trying to buy their property back, their channels and whatnot back. So,
yeah.
Hopefully they get the chance to do that.
Yeah. And moving on, we're going into the entertainment portion of the show. We got news from Netflix that they have recently renewed their live-action Avatar The Last Airbender adaptation for 2 more seasons, which I guess means that they're going to be completing the trilogy. So,
yeah, just like the animated series that only went 3 seasons, they're doing that, and then that'll be it.
Yeah.
They said they're going to end it after 3.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that you kind of have to, because there's no more material after that. I mean, at least not yet. I mean, not until, you know, those side stories start coming out.
Yeah, until they do Legend of Korra.
Yeah.
Live action.
Yeah.
Obviously. So, that's cool. I've heard decent things about the show.
It's good, but it also has some strange writing choices that kind of don't really work for some of it.
Is that from adapting a show that has like 20 episodes a season into like 8?
Yeah, that also like that. There's some of the weird things they've done to some of the character arcs. But other than that, yeah, it's actually pretty solid. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And speaking of something in the other side of quality, Baywatch is being rebooted on Fox.
Sure. I don't really know much about the original Baywatch because I don't remember.
Ass and titties. That's all you need to
know. I
mean,
that's, but, like, I don't know what channel it was on.
When it was on Fox.
Okay. I thought it was on something else, but either way, it was like, I don't know why I would watch it. It was a very boring show as a kid.
The original definitely was very boring. Honestly, and it was
seems like very vapid shows. Just like
it was very
these
vapid.
People, yeah, being you know working on a beach and like
yeah,
they save some people. That's cool.
Yeah,
and there's probably a lot of drama.
Yeah, but I mean, it wasn't good drama.
No, it was a show made for putting hot people on.
Yeah, this was like before you know cable porn was a thing. So Well, I mean,
I feel like you watch the scrambled channels and you get more action out of that.
Okay, this was before online porn was a thing. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
At least as widespread.
Or it took you a couple minutes just to see an image?
Yeah. A couple minutes, dude. Like 10 minutes. This is like 96 we're talking about here, bro. So Baywatch being rebooted on Fox. I have no idea why.
Mostly maybe we'll add a story that's good.
Maybe. I mean, stranger things do happen. Things. Yeah.
If you're rebooting anything in this day and age from that era, you got to add story to it.
You got to at least have a good writer on board.
That's like what was so great about Cobra Kai is like, there's just these loosely weird movies of just like, we've made more of them, but then they gave them a purpose in Cobra Kai.
Yeah. And then we got a bunch of trailers here. We got a couple of Prime Video trailers. First one is for Prime Video's The Idea of You.
Yeah. Based on a book that is kind of based on, not really based on, it's loosely based on this, the coincidental concept of a huge pop star, you know, part of a boy band, the lead singer that ends up falling for a single mom.
Mm-hmm.
Whose daughter is hugely into the band. They go to, I think, Coachella in this.
Yeah.
And then the mom gets into a relationship with the lead singer. Mm-hmm. It's a weird thing. Kind of basically like Harry Styles.
Yeah.
Thing that people found out about him in when he was in One Direction.
Yeah.
He often dated older women.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. And yeah. Seems like a pretty solid movie.
Yeah.
That'll be out May 2nd.
Yeah. And we also got an official trailer for Prime Video's Fallout. And guess what? It actually looks good.
Yeah, it's got the Fallout stuff in it. So.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually got like the goofy Fallout humor as well.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. I didn't know they were going to be able to get that right, but they did.
Yeah.
And apparently this is going to be like canon as well. So,
I mean, they can make anything canon. That's just set it all different.
And
times.
They can also unmake it as well. So, yeah but apparently this is supposed to be, this is supposed to take place like a few years after Fallout 4.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And what city is this near?
Fallout 4 took place, I believe, in and around the Boston metropolitan area.
Yeah, but this show, what's that?
Are
they also in Boston, or are they somewhere else? Hold on. The description doesn't have anything here about it.
Well, the thing with Fallout is it's kind of hard to tell unless someone tells you. Because, remember, most of the world after the war is basically a desert wasteland, so I'm not entirely sure. Let's see.
Maybe it's LA. I don't know. The initial shot has like a big boardwalk.
There,
kind of
like
thing.
You do see like NCR flags here and there. So it is possible that some of it takes place in California, or at least in the Southwest.
Popping around.
Yeah, it's they might pop in to the Mojave so that they could do some New Vegas related stuff. I'm not sure. But so far, it looks like this is in California-related territory.
Yeah, there's a shop with the big donuts. That's probably L.A. It'd be neat, though I don't have Prime, so I can't watch it either way. April 11th, all episodes arrive, so you can just watch it all at once.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And let's see, what else? We also got an official trailer for Netflix's Ripley. This is a series based on the Ripley books by Patricia Highsmith, famously made into the film The Talented Mr. Ripley. Tom Ripley is this a traveling con artist and sociopath who is also a serial killer who always manages to get away with his shit. So,
yeah. Yeah, this looks pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Be on Netflix April 4th.
Mm-hmm.
So you can check that out. Limited series, so.
Oh, yeah.
A handful of episodes there.
Mm-hmm.
It's all black and white, so that's pretty cool look for them.
Damn straight. And last but not least, we got a teaser trailer for Netflix's Parasite The Grey, which is... Yeah, go ahead.
It's based on an anime?
Yeah, it's based on Parasite.
But weirdly enough, it's being made by a Korean studio.
Yep.
It's like a live action thing, which I hadn't noticed this, but I saw some of the comments are like, yeah, it's weird that they are doing a live action thing, because usually adaptations of anime done in Korea are webtoons.
Yeah.
And so them going all out for a live action thing is pretty notable here. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's about these weird parasites that start taking over human hosts that allow them to do weird things, like their heads split out into almost like the Granado in RE4.
Oh, yeah.
But not a uniform form of that. They're kind of a lot of different head designs of
the parasites thing are, if anything, extremely uncanny. I've read the original like manga and watched the anime. And the thing about the parasites is that once they overtake someone, they basically take over their entire biological mechanisms, and they'll like the original story, like the dude has like a parasite that ends up taking over his hand, so his hand basically becomes sentient. There's like other ones where it like takes over like dogs. There's one where it like took over an old man and it like turned his whole head into like a mouth. And it's even weirder because they don't really understand like human social cues or anything. So like when they're talking in a group of parasites, or like talking in a group, they're all like sit down in like various in chairs that are just like set up all over the place without any order, and they're all facing different directions, and they have hard times like communicating with human mouths, so their mouths are like doing these weird motions when they're talking. It's very bizarre.
Yeah. So yeah, this looks neat in a very gruesome kind of way.
Oh yeah, it is. yeah, but that's
April 5th, so
yeah,
you can watch Ripley and then Parasite right after it, as everyone intends, and then Fallout a week later. All normal things to watch together.
Oh yeah. But I do believe with that we have got ourselves a show. Yes, we do. We have got ourselves a show. So I would like to remind all of our listeners, got a question, comment, or something you want us to read on air, get in contact with us at letsweekenders@gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. We got a link for it in the show notes. Also, on top of Apple Podcasts, you can catch our little bit of unscripted shenanigans at TuneIn, Google Play, RSS, archive.org, or any kind of podcast aggregator that you can think of. And, you know, you can just suffer along another election year with us, because that's what it is, folks. Strap in, because it's getting ready to start any day now. Oh, that is going to be so much fun. But once again, thank you, Chris, for coming along on this ride with me. If you liked what you have heard, please do not hesitate to share us with your friends, your family, your coworkers, your casual acquaintances, or your mortal enemies, and everyone in between, because they may hate you, but they just might turn out to like us. And that's a beat we can all dance to, except you, because if they end up hating you, they might just end up dancing on your grave. But yeah, you know, everybody needs a hobby. But yeah, so we're going to go ahead and shut it down here. Join us next week when we are going to start getting full on into election year bullshit. And that's just going to be so, so very much fun. Goodbye, everybody.